This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Today, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals denied Representative Tom DeLay's request that the money laundering charges against him be dismissed or sent back to a lower court for immediate trial. DeLay has been charged with funneling corporate contributions through the Republican National Committee to state legislative candidates. Texas state law prohibits corporate money from being spent on campaigns. On Saturday, DeLay announced his intention to step down permanently as House Majority Leader. DeLay said he was stepping down because he couldn't allow opponents to divide and distract House Republicans. DeLay's decision to step aside from the House Majority Leadership comes at a time when the Republican Party is suffering under fractured leadership, and many members of the party are jittery following the plea agreement reached by former Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Later in our program on Talk of the Nation, Talk of the Nation opinion page looks at the new television series, The Book of Daniel. But first, Representative Tom DeLay. Who is he, and why was he so important to the Republican leadership? Now that he's decided to step down, how will that affect the Republican agenda in Congress? And does it have implications for the midterm elections later this year? Well, we'd particularly like to hear from Republican listeners in our audience. Did DeLay do the right thing in stepping down? Who do you want to see leading House Republicans in his place? We have split lines today, so if you're a Republican and you want to join our conversation, please do, and call us at 800-344-3893. So for Republican callers, please call us at 800-344-3893. Democrats, you're invited too. You may join us at 800-344-3864. So the Democratic line, 800-344-3864. The Republican line, 800-344-3893. Joining me now live, he doesn't have to call at all. He can sit right across me, is Matthew Continetti. He's a writer for the Weekly Standard, and he's in our studio. Thank goodness. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this latest ruling from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. What does that mean for Tom DeLay in his case?
Well, most immediately it means that it likely he's going to face a trial. And we're not unsure about the timing of the trial. We're unsure about what will be revealed in the course of the trial or how long it may take. But certainly this would be distracting DeLay from his majority leader duties if he had run to retain his post.
So it makes it much more certain. Any possibility that there might not be a trial, this could be dropped. That's gone. So that may be one of the reasons. But the announcement on Saturday came after lobbyist Jake Abramoff worked out his plea agreement. How closely is Tom DeLay implicated in that scandal?
Well, very closely. As Tom DeLay put it once, Jack Abramoff was one of his closest friends in Washington. Endorsements from DeLay on behalf of Abramoff's clients, including the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands, the U.S. territory in the Pacific, graced those clients. There was also a DeLay endorsement of the National Center for Public Policy Research, a think tank that Abramoff worked closely with and used as a shell to funnel money to various charities and causes tied to his financial interests. So DeLay is linked closely to this scandal. Also, DeLay's former aides and staffers are linked closely, one by the name of Tony Rudy, a former chief of staff or Representative DeLay, is alluded to in the criminal information released as part of Abramoff's guilty plea.
So he had originally, in when it was just the money laundering scandal that is part of the court proceedings in Texas, DeLay said he had no intention of permanently giving up his seat. What has changed? Was Abramoff the only factor here?
I believe so. I think it's stunning in a way how quickly we traveled from Abramoff's two separate plea agreements, one in Washington in the investigation into his lobbying practices here, the other in Florida in the investigation into how he acquired a casino line, the Sun Cruise casino line. Those pleas happened on Tuesday and Wednesday, and on Saturday, of course, Representative DeLay said he was stepping down and would not try to reclaim his seat. The speed at which these events unfolded is staggering, actually.
Now, when you say seat, we're talking about the leadership position, but he will run for re-election.
That's correct.
How has all of this affected that possibility, his chances for re-election?
Well, DeLay was always somewhat of a marked man going into the midterm elections this year. for several reasons, one of which, of course, is he's the most prominent House Republican. Another reason is that the gerrymandering scheme that he was a vocal advocate for and which he pushed through the Texas state legislature that resulted in five new Republican congressmen in this Congress, actually diluted the Republican support he had in his own district around Sugar Land, Texas. And so that made it harder for him to reclaim his seat. Now these new scandal troubles only means that he's going to face a well-financed challenger.
Talking about Tom DeLay, on our program today, we'll talk a bit about his legacy. We're taking a look at his legal problems at the moment with Matthew Continetti, a staff writer for the Weekly Standard, and taking your phone calls. Republicans, we want to hear from you at 344-3893 and Democrats 344-3864. Let's go to John, who's on the line from San Diego. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was just calling, as a Republican to talk about the need for more people in leadership positions that are more in line with kind of the McCain model and following finance rules. And Tom DeLay didn't do it, and I think we need people like him out and people that have more integrity in that area in.
Hmm. Thank you for your call, John. Is that something that we're going to hear more from Republicans, their sense that there may be a split within the party and that there's a division on this question of campaign finance?
We'll hear a lot more about lobbying reform in the coming months. Whether the House Republicans are going to elect someone to lead them in the model of John McCain is relatively unlikely. In fact, the two leading candidates, Representative John Boehner of Ohio and Representative Roy Blunt of Missouri, are conservatives in the DeLay mold. They have close ties with the business community. They're very avid fundraisers, and they're willing to work hard to push through very conservative legislation.
Well, and it seems to me there's more to the leadership than simply lobbying reform and campaign financing. So it strikes me that it's possible to get this kind of legislation through without changing the nature of the leadership very much.
That's true, and of course it's likely, in fact almost certain, that Congress will pass and President Bush will sign some sort of lobbying reform this summer so that representatives and senators up for re-election can go back to their states and their districts in the fall and say that they are tackling the problem of corruption and lobbying in Washington.
You've talked a little bit about Congressman Boehner and Roy Blunt. Tell us a little more about them and what divides them, what separates them.
Boehner is a veteran. He was elected in 1990. He was part of kind of the first trickle of Republican congressmen, new Republican blood into the House, which, of course, culminated in the 1994 Republican Revolution. He had close ties with Newt Gingrich. In fact, he's been in the leadership before, but after 1998, he left the leadership after the Republican losses in those elections. Blunt is a little bit newer. He was first elected in 1996. He has very close ties with the K Street lobbying corridor, and he's more of a conservative in the DeLay mold, southern conservative, more social conservative. Close ties to the president, actually. I think the White House would most like to see Representative Blunt take the post.
Well, close ties to the president, also close ties to Tom DeLay. He's seen as a protege of DeLay, who really chose him to be the party's whip. Now, is he too close for the comfort of the Republican Party and the Republican House?
I think it would be a stretch for Democrats to make the argument that Blunt is a DeLay clone. He is different. They're different people, and they have different tactics. And I think that we've seen in the few months where Blunt was the acting majority leader, a different approach to whipping votes, to making sure the caucus stays in line. In fact, Blunt, it seems, had some difficulty doing that and resulted in several fractious congressmen. Interestingly enough, today, Representative Mike Pence, one of the leaders of the House conservatives, said that he would step out of the race, which means that you're basically going to see a contest between these two gentlemen, Boehner and Blunt.
Well, you talked about the case the Democrats might make, but I want to stick with how the Republicans are going to perceive this. And again, getting back to John's question, our first caller, whether or not Republican voters want to see a little more distance between the next majority leader and Tom DeLay.
That's probably true. I mean, I think it's important to distinguish from what Republican voters may want on the national scene that you would find in the Senate or a future presidential candidate, and the internal politics of the House, which are very different and roiling. And, of course, the caucus is not entirely representative of the country because you have very different elements and regional differences and such. There's no question that certain conservatives would like to see a more reform-based party. And, of course, Newt Gingrich was right out there on Tuesday, last Tuesday, when Jack Abramoff announced his plea arrangements, calling not only for DeLay to step down, which is an interesting harbinger of what happened last weekend, but also for the Republicans to reclaim the mantle of the Reform Party. You're going to see more calls for that. And Senator McCain, who the caller mentioned, is, of course, probably the most prominent national spokesman and the most fitting spokesman for a return to reform values and what many consider conservative values of limiting government and taking decision-making out of the hands of the lobbyists.
Well, there's the ideological side, and where Roy Blunt seems to meet at least that test. But you talked earlier about the technical side of the job, getting the votes. And you, as you said, Republicans were unhappy with his inability to deliver votes when it came to cuts in social spending. And is that something that gets held against him when this vote comes up?
Well, looking down the legislative window for the rest of this year, we're going to have an immigration bill. We're going to have a lobbying reform package. It's going to be a requirement for the Republicans, a necessity almost, that they make the Bush tax cuts permanent this year. There's also going to be a lot of finagling about stem cells as we continue throughout this year. These are all positions and bills where it's very important to have conservative leadership who is able to generate massive majorities in the House, which is something Tom DeLay could do and Roy Blunt so far has not.
Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Continetti is a staff writer for the Weekly Standard, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. We're talking about the fate and fortunes of Tom DeLay and the Republican Party, and we're taking your phone calls this hour. Republicans, call us at 800-344-3893. Republicans, 800-344-3893. Democrats, give us a call at 344-3864. Our email is totn@npr.org. Coming up next, Republican strategist Ed Rogers joins us and NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington, talking about the political career of Tom DeLay and the political future of the GOP without DeLay in a leadership position. And we're doing something a bit different today because we want to hear how the Republicans view this. So if you're a Republican in our audience, we want to hear from you on one line, and that line would be 800-344-3893. 344-3893, the Republican line. And from Democrats, we will have you call in at 800-344-3864. So, Republicans, 800-344-3893. Democrats, 800-344-3864. And all of you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. Tom DeLay's career in the U.S. House of Representatives dates back to when he was first elected in 1984. And today, he's noted for being one of the most powerful and efficient operators on Capitol Hill. Joining us now to tell us a bit more about where Tom DeLay came from and how his political career got started is Jan Reed. He's co-author of The Hammer Comes Down, The Nasty, Brutish, and Shortened Political Life of Tom DeLay. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Jan Reed, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's go back to the early days growing up in Texas, his childhood. What were Tom DeLay's childhood and family like?
Well, he grew up in the brush country along the Mexico border, along the Rio Grande. His father was an oil field worker of some talent, and some of his childhood or adolescence was spent in Venezuela on various oil camps. And they came back to Corpus Christi, and his father went on and had an offshore oil company in the Gulf of Mexico. But he was a feisty little high school football player, and had too much good time when in college. His father very badly wanted him to go be a doctor and go to medical school, and his grades weren't quite up to that. And he married very soon after college, and somewhat of his philosophy, what you do is start a business. And what he had his first job after college was working in a pest control company in Houston. And so he went to the suburbs and with a number of partners, had for some years a pest control company in what Sugarland became his home base, although he lived in several suburbs on the way to Sugarland. And in 1978, he ran for the Texas legislature, and his timing was impeccable. Texas was in the process of just changing over to being a totally Democratic state on the mold of Lyndon Johnson to then becoming a completely Republican state, yeah. And he just happened to ride that crest.
Well, let me stop you there because I just want to get a brief recap. So he comes from oil money, goes to college, doesn't do very well, but whoops it up and has a good time, then starts a business and goes into politics. Is that what you do in Texas?
There's one misconception I may have laid there is that he didn't have oil money. These were people that they went and brought the oil out of the ground, and he was middle class, maybe upper middle class, but he didn't have a great deal of money, and he was always coming up the hard way. He was a backbencher in the legislature and scrabbled his way, and was when he came to Washington, he was hardly a star. He rode the coattails of President Reagan in the Mondale election, and won his suburban seat handily. But he did not have a star path laid out before him. He was of that generation of Kerry and Gore but his opportunities were not like that. He was very much back in the pack, and he had to work his way up, and he did.
He did, and he earned a reputation as being an efficient guy who really got things done. And how did he do all that? How did he manage to become such a successful operator as a majority leader?
Well, politically, a very important thing happened to him just his first term. He was a bit of a wild man when he was in his social life and when he was in Texas. And he's acknowledged he had quite a drinking problem then. And he came up there and he was just stressing out. He's going to drinking too many martinis and too many fundraisers in the very, very first session. And he had a real religious experience. And he became an evangelical Christian. And that became his base in a large way, as his political base. He had more credibility with the Christian right than probably any politician in the country. And so he was doing that. But he was also a student of the process and worked his way up. He got crosswise with Gingrich. Gingrich bumped him back at one point, but he made his way in, worked his way into the Gingrich team, and then when Gingrich started failing, he was part of an attempted coup to force him out. But he just kept coming. He was really a driving force in the impeachment of President Clinton, even though it was certain that if they did this, he was going to be, acquitted in the Senate.
Is there I just wondered if there's anything in his early career that would point to this that could have had you predict, say, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, that this day might have come for Tom DeLay.
Well, on both counts, everyone that knew him during his Texas legislature days told us he was the last one that anyone would have thought would have risen to this level of power and stature. But they also said the idea that he would be looking at a criminal prosecution, and there was some chance that he would go to jail, and certainly in dire danger of being disgraced. They could no one foresaw that either. He was a principled business conservative with an ideological agenda, and he sought power and got it, and it seems to happen. Hubris takes over.
What you know about him, would you say that he can revive his career now that it's in the state it's in?
No, not as a national figure. He may survive this election. He's got some opponents in a Republican primary, but he's also got a pretty credible Democrat who was one of the incumbent congressmen. His name's Nick Lamson. He was one of those who was gerrymandered out in the redistricting that your prior guest talked about, and so he's got a real race on his hands. While, as you were saying, he's got a trial for money laundering coming up that he's not going to be able to dodge. He was hoping to get that thrown out, and it was always sort of a forlorn hope that this was going to happen and he could go back and reclaim his mantle. The calendar was working against him, and also his colleagues were just getting very nervous. He had become a white hot figure and a lightning rod.
Thank you very much, Jan Reed. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Jan Reed is co-author of The Hammer Comes Down, The Nasty, Brutish, and Shortened Political Life of Tom DeLay. He joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. We're talking about the fortunes of Tom DeLay today, taking your phone calls, and we're splitting them up today. So if you're a Republican or tend to vote Republican, we'd like to hear from you on 800-344-3893. Democrats call in on 800-344-3864. Republicans now are faced with the immediate need to fill the hole left by Tom DeLay, and they're preparing for an election of a new House Majority Leader. Joining us now to talk about where they're going is Ed Rogers, a Republican strategist and chairman of Barber Griffith & Rogers, LLC. He joins us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Hi, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Tom DeLay has given up his role as House Majority Leader. Republicans may have a contentious election to replace him, and then there's the whole Abramoff story. So how bad do you think things are for Republicans in Congress at the moment?
Well, things certainly aren't good. They could be better. And right now, you would want to be coming into the new year with a clear leadership team and a clear agenda. And has all of this sidetracked the Republican effort in Washington for the time being? Yes, it has. How long it's going to go on, what kind of consequences it's going to have politically, nobody knows yet. But we're in for a few more weeks of more uncertainty than I would certainly like for us to see as a Republican and a fan of the Republican cause in the U.S. and a fan of this administration.
Ed, let's go to the phones right now and take a call from Griffin, who is in Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Griffin.
Hello.
Calling in on the Republican line?
Yes. I've been concerned over the last several months, maybe the last year or so, about the image that the Republican leadership has as almost these heavy-handed tyrants with no connection to the American people. And I was wondering, with Tom DeLay going out, and will either one of his potential successors be able to bring about a new image for the Republican Party, or is it going to keep the Republicans going in the same vein?
Ed?
That's a fair question. And historically, congressional leadership has been relatively anonymous. When careers sort of blow up or you get a particular character like a Newt Gingrich on the scene, that changes. But again, historically, they have been pretty anonymous. I think that is changing. In the world of live TV, in the world of blogs, in the world of cable news, I think that the public persona of congressional leadership is more important than ever. I think that will be an ingredient of what is considered coming up in these elections, and I'm not sure the election is going to really be between just two people. I think you may have more. I don't know anything. I'm not being coy, but I'm just saying I would be surprised if just the Congressman Blunt and Congressman Boehner is the race that you're going to see. I think there is room and probably an appetite for some dark horse candidates to at least get in the race.
Talking about the legacy of Tom DeLay, the future for DeLay and the Republican Party with Ed Rogers, Republican strategist. And also joining us is NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts, who joins us by phone from her home. Hi, Cokie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Tell us about Tom DeLay's recent, what does this mean now for the Republican Party? And Ed, you heard talking about, first of all, the fight for that leadership position. Do you think it'll expand?
Well, I agree with that. It's likely to expand. And look, we've had lots of examples in the past of this. One of the most dramatic was in the 1970s when the Democrats in the House were at war with each other, where one group of them supported Dick Bolling of Missouri, the other group supported Phil Burton of California. And the animus between those two groups went on for years to come. You'd be trying to explain some piece of legislation, and it didn't make sense who was on what side. And it turned out they were still fighting the battle over majority leader. And what happened in that case is that Jim Wright from Texas ended up just sort of walking down the aisle between the two camps and got elected majority leader. Something similar could happen in this situation because the House Republicans are feeling very skittish. And the fact that they're nervous about the upcoming election, the fact that they're feeling like they've not really been responded to in many cases by their leadership, could have some younger member, somebody characterized as a young Turk, getting into the race. But both John Boehner and Roy Blunt are very substantial people. They have done the things that are necessary to do to run for leader in terms of courting your fellow members, going to their districts and doing fundraisers for them. I mean, there's an awful lot of care and feeding of members in a leadership election. And that is something people on the outside never get, is that this is so much more personal and so much more individual than any of our conversations about, well, who's good on TV and who's from where and who's going to make a good image for the party.
Not to mention policy and ideology.
But right,
let me just remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking with Republican strategist Ed Rogers and NPR's Cokie Roberts, and we're talking about the fortunes and future of Tom DeLay, and we're taking phone calls this hour. We've heard from two Republicans. Let's go to the Democratic line, where who is on the line there? I think we've lost that phone call, so I'm going to go to Cindy, who's on the line from Knoxville.
Hi,
Cindy.
Yeah. I have to say that as a Democrat, I couldn't be happier that the Republicans have fallen off their moral high horse to start with. However, I'm really concerned about the Democrats and how committed they are to real significant financial reform, because all the members of Congress have a vested interest in benefiting personally from financial arrangements that are made with lobbyists and PACs and so forth. And the real losers in the end are the people that they forget that they represent. I'm listening to Cokie Roberts and all these people talking about all these people jockeying for power and for position, but Jesus, they're representatives of the people, and that is lost.
Well, let me put that question first to Cokie, then to Ed Rogers, whether or not there will be meaningful reform, since both parties really depend on this money.
Well, every time there's an effort at campaign finance reform or lobbying reform, people get very nervous because it does affect them. And they're always the law of unintended consequences always affects things so that they think they're changing something for the better to clean things up. And sometimes it opens a loophole that makes things worse. And that's happened both with political action committees and with soft money, the unregulated money. And then they try to patch that hole and another one opens up. But I would disagree with the caller about her complete cynicism about the Congress. The truth is the most powerful single lobby in Washington is the AARP, the old folks lobby. And that's because old folks vote. It's not that they give a lot of money. They're tight. But they do vote, and they vote in large numbers, and they vote their interest. So members of Congress do respond to the public if the public makes their views well known.
Ed, let me put a slightly different question to you, and that is with regard to the president's agenda and the Republican agenda. Does this fight hurt the effort to get the Republican agenda through?
Sure it does. If nothing else, it gives it a late start. If nothing else, it cast another layer of cynicism over just about any message coming out of Washington right now. And as I said earlier, ideally, the beginning of January, Congress coming back, you'd want to come back unified, organized. You'd wait for the president's State of the Union address. Much of that would be pre-coordinated with Republican allies in Congress. and you would launch the legislative year sure-footed and in a crisp, organized fashion, or as crisp as possible with the groups being what they are in Washington. Instead, you're going to have some weeks of an intramural fight. It's going to be hard for the White House to get all of the coordination, all of the resonance they would want in launching their agenda that'll be compiled in the State of the Union address the third week or so of January. And so, yeah, it makes things tougher.
All right, Ed, we're going to continue this conversation with Republican strategist Ed Rogers and NPR's Cokie Roberts about Tom DeLay, Future for the Republicans, when we return, plus our weekly opinion page this week, a take on the controversial new TV show, The Book of Daniel. Stay with us. Right now, we're wrapping up our discussion on Tom DeLay. Still with me are NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts and Republican strategist Ed Rogers. Cokie, let's take a look at this position of House Majority Leader. It's certainly a powerful position and one that a lot of people seem to want. Well, how is it different? I mean, what is the role, and how is that different from Speaker of the House?
Well, the Speaker is a constitutional office. It is written into the Constitution, and he is, of course, the head of his party, and speakers have tended to be quite partisan over most of our history. But it is a different position in that it is not the leader of the majority in exactly the same way. And often the speaker is called upon to step back and to take a different role, or at least occasionally he is. He's also in the line of succession to the presidency. I mean, it's a much more ceremonial but also substantial role. The majority leader is the, I mean, just as it says, the leader of the majority party. He's the bulldog. He's the guy who's there to lead the partisan fight. And Tom DeLay, from that perspective, you've got to say, did it better than almost anybody. And you know, some would say almost too well, which is one of the reasons House does sort of distance itself from him.
And how did he, in terms of how you do that job well and how you do it legally? I mean, what makes a good majority leader? What is it that you do that gives you that that credential?
What you do is you get the program of the majority passed. I mean, that's the, thing you do. And when you have a White House, when you also have your party occupying the White House, you try to get the president's program passed, but you also have a lot of say over what the president's program should be.
So you have some
and,
input.
And have those conversations with the person in the Oval Office.
Ed Rogers, Tom DeLay was also good at getting people reelected. This is sort of outside the House, good at fundraising, allocating money. With him gone, are conservatives worried that the 2006 elections won't be properly managed?
It's too hard. It's too far off to say what sort of political impact this is going to have in 2006, but Tom DeLay was a tireless worker for his caucus and for his members. He had remarkable energy that he applied to the politics of fundraising, of taking care of his members, of helping to prioritize the races that the Republican majority could pick up in Congress and facilitating resources getting to those races. No secret. And will somebody have the kind of energy, ability, infrastructure to apply to the races that Tom DeLay had? That's unlikely.
Ed, it's Cokie here. Don't you think that one of the reasons that he was allowed to stay so long was exactly that? I mean, I'm amazed at how long that his fellow Republicans allowed him to remain majority leader, given all of the ethical
problems. By Washington standards, even Tom DeLay took himself out a little early. He has remarkable goodwill among his caucus. He performed for his members. He kept his finger on their pulse. He knew what they needed. He delivered for them, and like I said, had a huge reservoir of goodwill right up to the day that he resigned, or took himself out of the leadership anyway.
I mean, Frankie even served him donuts all the time, and they loved those donuts.
Man, I might run for office if you keep... Yeah, that sounds... Well, Cokie, let me ask you if there's something native to the office that makes that... Is something, you know, is there something about being majority leader that, you know, puts you in a position to be helpful to your party, or was he just simply good at both?
Well, you don't become majority leader without being helpful to your party. My father, Hale Boggs, was majority leader of the Democrats briefly in 1971 and 1972, and he became majority leader because he had already performed those services. I mean, that's how you win the election, is that you're, as I said earlier, you're out in the district, you're, as Boehner and Blunt both have been. You raise the money, you help the candidate, and then you keep it up. My father was actually killed in a plane crash going out with a candidate that he was helping get reelected in 1972. So, yes, that absolutely goes with the territory.
Let's take one more call. We'll go out to Chris somewhere in America. Hi, Chris.
It's actually Cincinnati.
All right.
The question I have for you is, I'm hearing a lot about permanent tax cuts, but I'm not hearing anything about the, you know, going back to the idea of balancing the budget and fiscal responsibility.
And you're
going to hear a lot about it, and that's one of the things that some of the Young Turk conservatives in the Republican caucus are complaining about, is that they're saying we need to get some true conservatism in here. We need to talk a lot more about fiscal discipline. The problem is that we're in an election year, and any time you start talking about cutting programs in an election year, you start talking about hurting groups of voters. And Ronald Reagan discovered that these programs have constituencies, and they're not all Democratic constituencies. And so it becomes very, very difficult to really be fiscally conservative in a year when you're having a tight election.
Corky, this is the second or third time we've heard from Republicans or self-identified Republicans in this program saying they're concerned about the direction of the party. Is there anything that we'll be able to glean from the election, who is chosen as majority leader, about that direction?
Probably not, unless you do see some young conservative who is trying to pull the party in a more conservative direction elected. But Ed, I'd be much more curious. I'd defer to Ed on this one.
Yeah, well, I would also look at the President's State of Union address and to see what he's going to have to say about spending. There is a growing outside the Beltway sentiment within our own party that we have for too long lost our way as being the party of budget discipline and responsible spending. There hasn't been a serious fight about spending in Washington ever since Clinton really boxed the Republicans' ears in the 1996 time frame over spending in 98. So it is time, and there is a growing restlessness in our party over somebody that's going to stand up and say enough's enough. But having said that, that has in recent times been a political loser.
Right.
There has been very little real constituency for meaningful budget cuts. And
everybody thinks it's that law firm of waste, fraud, and abuse that could be cut.
Well, we will certainly stay tuned. Ed Rogers, Republican strategist, chairman of Barbara Griffith & Rogers, thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
And Cokie Roberts, thank you so very much.
Always good to be with you, Frank.
We'll go from newspeak to prophecy as we evaluate the Book of Daniel on this program. Talk of the Nation. Stay with us.